Welcome to the Determined Truth Podcast.
What the truth? You can't handle the truth.
Where we aim to explore questions of truth, the scriptures, and what it means for the church today. Here are your hosts, Rob Dalrymple and Vinny Angelo.
Hey, welcome in, everyone. We are in Revelation 21, verses 1 through 8. So this is the introduction to the New Jerusalem, and we're finally, man, this is the home stretch. This is Lord of the Rings, Return of the King, where the hobbits go back to the Shire finally. There's only four more endings to go, but I feel like we're finally almost there, Rob.
Yeah, this is what we've been working towards all along, with the New Jerusalem. This is the good part, finally, that we can say, yes, let's rejoice. Excellent. You want to start off? Let's read Revelation 21, 1 through 8, if we can start off that way.
Sure. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people, and God himself will be with them as their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain anymore, for the former things have passed away. And he who was seated on the throne said, behold, I am making all things new. Also he said, write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true. And he said to me, it is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To the thirsty I will give from the spring of the water of life without payment. The one who conquers will have this heritage, and I will be his God, and he will be my son. But as for the cowardly, the faithless, the detestable, as for the murderers, the sexually immoral, sorcerers, idolaters, and all liars, their portion will be in the lake that burns with fire and sulfur, which is the second death.
I'm going to turn now to chapter 7, read the end of chapter 7, because I think this also relates. What we discussed in the account of the great multitude in Revelation 7, 9 through 17 was that it was like this proleptic look, which, and proleptic means to leap forward, this proleptic look at the people of God in the New Jerusalem. And so I think it's relevant here. So chapter 7, verse 15, it says, for this reason they are before the throne of God, and they serve him day and night in his temple. And he who sits on the throne will spread his tabernacle over them. They will hunger no longer, nor thirst anymore. Nor will the sun beat down on them, nor any heat. For the Lamb in the center of the throne will be their shepherd, and he will guide them to the springs of the water of life, and God will wipe away every tear from their eyes.
That's a total parallel.
Yeah, exactly, and we'll see more of it in chapter 22 as well. Yeah, this is the exciting part. So just very briefly, just to remind ourselves of the structure of the book, because it's really critical. We had the account of the great prostitute, the account of the bride that's going to come up, those two parallel accounts, chapter 17, 1 through 19, 10. And 21:9 through 22:9. In the middle of that, which we're still in, is this bridge section that began with the second coming of Jesus. Christ comes down, and then he judges the three enemies of God's people, the beast and the false prophet first, Satan second, death and Hades third. And then we have this last unit within this section of the introduction to the New Jerusalem. So the idea being that the bride cannot come down, even though the harlot has been judged, because the enemies of Christ must actually face the final judgment. So Christ descends, he judges the enemies of God's people, and now there's an introduction to the New Jerusalem. In other words, this is actually not the consummation itself or the climax of the story. It's the introduction to the climax of the story.
Okay. When we see in verses 1 and 2 about the new heaven and the new earth coming down, because the first heaven or the first earth had passed away and the sea was no more, this seems to be talking about destruction of the old creation. In 2 Peter 3, we see that it's destroyed by fire. I know that even growing up in the evangelical subcircles I was in, which is funny, as you and I are recording this yesterday in real time, was Earth Day. And so in my conservative, ultra conservative setting, like Earth Day is bad. It's what the hippies are doing, and God's just going to destroy the earth anyway and redo it. So we don't really have to care about these sorts of things, because it's all going to get destroyed anyway. Is that what's being talked about here?
Yeah, it's really important to understand, because it has such a significant impact upon issues like global warming and what do we do with it, and issues of creation care. What do we do with that? The first thing I would point back to is, go look what happened with Jesus. Jesus is the first fruit from among the dead. What happened? His body that died is the body that rose. So if that's true, then when we resurrect, the body that dies is the body that rises. Now, we can get into the scientific issues and go, it's decayed. I don't think we know the answer to that. But the point of that is that the creation itself also is going to undergo this resurrection. So Romans chapter 8, let me turn there now. Romans chapter 8, verses 18 and following, says, I consider the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that will be revealed in us. And then verse 19 says, the anxious longing of the creation waits eagerly for the revealing of the sons of God. Oh, that's interesting. The creation's waiting for us to be revealed as the sons of God in this resurrected sense. Verse 20, the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its slavery to corruption into the freedom of the glory of the children of God. For we know the whole creation groans and suffers the pains of childbirth together until now. And not only this, but we also, having the first fruits of the Spirit, even we ourselves groan, waiting eagerly for the adoption as sons, the redemption of our bodies. What Paul seems to do there is he seems to connect our resurrection and the fact that we're suffering in this present world, but our sufferings won't be compared to the glory that will be revealed in us. And even the creation is groaning and suffering in the present, awaiting that day when it also will be liberated from its bondage to decay. So I think what we see then is that even the creation will be resurrected. In other words, when we read Revelation 21:1, it says, I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth passed away. Oh, God gets rid of the first heaven and first earth. That's done. And then he creates a new one. It's like, no, what he does is he restores the old one. The first heaven and the first earth passed away. What passes away is death. What passes away is suffering, decay, disease, sin. That's what passes away. Same thing in our resurrected bodies. What passes away is the corruption of the flesh, the suffering, the sin, the disease, the things that bring about decay and suffering. So also with the creation. So if we go to 2 Peter 3 really quickly, verse 7 says, by his word, the present heavens and earth are being reserved for fire, being kept for the day of judgment and destruction of ungodly men. That leads to this idea of, oh, heavens and earth pass away. It's destroyed by fire. It's consumed. But fire is a purifying agent. It's the fires of judgment, the fires of purification that purify it. So the sin, the disease, the death, the decay, all that's destroyed. And then God resurrection restores the creation. So I have a suspicion, we can speculate about this a lot the next couple of weeks as we discuss the New Jerusalem, that the New Jerusalem, the new creation, is actually going to be a lot like what we have now. Mm-hmm. No, but maybe there's mountains and valleys and rivers and roads, and maybe it's Pangaea. We don't know what it's going to be like, but I think there's going to be a high correlation between the present creation and the future one, just like I think there will be with the resurrection bodies. Anything you have to add to that or any thoughts on that?
I think it's interesting to do the speculation, but this is where I also go to my childhood and I see the lack of fruit of theological speculation, where you're spending so much time speculating and creating a construct that you're actually not worried about the here and the now. In therapy, my therapist would refer to this as future tripping, where you're only worried about the future and you're not actually engaged in the present. And so we oftentimes do this when it comes to this. We're so worried about what's going to happen in the future that, okay, what do you do with the now? And so even going back to the idea of like today is the, what is today? April 23rd. So April 22nd was Earth Day. So I have this lovely congregant who she's always in my classes and she's like a master gardener and she's very homeopathic and that sort of thing. And so her and I were talking on Sunday, the day before, and she was talking about how tomorrow is Earth Day. And for her, she has a conviction. She says, I think like Christians need to reclaim that, but not as Earth Day. Why we need to call this Creation Day and actually spend time talking about creation care. And not it's about the earth, but it's about what God created. And it was a lovely conversation and reframed it in a way. I still need to unpack it, but reframed it in a way where it's like, oh, like creation matters and the earth matters. Who was I reading yesterday? They made the illustration when it came to this, where as image bearers, Adam and Eve's job was to care for creation. Mm-hmm. And it might have been in Carmen Imes's book on bearing God's image, but I think it was. I'll have to go back and look, so I might falsely be accrediting something to her. The idea was that Adam and Eve in our job now, we are basically park rangers. We're not in charge of the park like it's ours. I am the king of Yosemite or something like that. But I am charged with protecting it and overseeing it and make sure it's cared for. And that's the job of human beings, not just looking about what it's going to be like in the future, but okay, but what do we do with it now?
That's really good. One is, what happens if thinking of the future impacts the way we live today?
It will, one way or another.
Yeah.
So how will it impact it? Yeah.
But the idea of, I don't know what you call it, your therapist called future or whatever it was that you
future tripping.
But what if future tripping is a means of coping with the present, because it's the blessed mm-hmm. hope that we long for. So I can endure the present because I long for the future. I can endure the grief and the loss of a loved one because I know that someday I'll be reunited. Mm-hmm. At the same time, also, what if, and I think this is a very important point, the idea of the contemporary Western Christians is we don't have to worry about the creation care at all because it's going to burn up and mm-hmm. the New Jerusalem is some future, distinct, different thing. But what if we recognize that the New Jerusalem is a restoration of this? And therefore, it impacts the way we live today mm-hmm. because we are called to care for the creation because it's the creation that's going to be resurrected. I think that might begin to change the way we think about, oh, burning up fossil fuels and destroying things or,
yes.
or caring for trees and forests and animals and things of that nature. Aside, I just had someone that is deeply grieving and an animal. And I said, there are dogs in the New Jerusalem. I said, mm-hmm. and that comes from a biblical scholar. And it wasn't just a pastoral, hey, yep. I want to make yep. you feel better. It's like, there have to be animals in the New Jerusalem.
Yeah, exactly.
There were animals in the garden. I think there are. And I think that there's a lot of correspondence between the present creation and the future one. So a couple of things to keep discussing as we move forward.
Yeah, yeah. In verse 1, it says, then I saw new heavens and earth first pass away, and the sea was no more. Question on this, and I know we talked yeah. about it years ago when we had a Dr. Jace Brodhurst on, who you just did a live stream with about Gog and Magog. So mm-hmm, in mm-hmm. April of 2024, if people want to check out mm-hmm. the YouTube channel, and you guys did a great survey of that. Thank but when you. We had him on for the Mark series, was it Mark 6 that we were talking about? It was when Jesus was walking on water, encountering with yeah. Mark 4, that's what it was. And so we had a question about the sea. In a Sunday school class a few weeks ago, I had given a quick imagery of the sea. Mm-hmm. We were talking about creation, the Holy Spirit, and how the Spirit yeah. was hovering over the face
over
of the water.
The waters,
and I just started looking about exploring real quickly about in the ancient Near East, the idea of water and what that meant.
Okay.
And it was great because instantly, like the whole class, we went on this rabbit trail and they're like, well, what about this passage then? It must mean this.
Yeah.
I just gave them the key to unlock biblical yeah. theology of water, right? Or I guess it'd be more just the background of water. But someone brought that up. Wait a minute then, in Revelation 21, when it says that there will be no more sea,
yeah,
we literalize it and say, oh, there's going to be no more water and ocean in the
right,
new world.
Right, right, right.
But they started making connections saying, but if this is the way they thought about it, it probably means something else, which is a great yeah. catch by them. What do you, how would you understand that? We probably don't want to interpret this literally. There's no, because if there's no more ocean, that means there's no more clouds, there's no more rain, which means there's no more vegetation to be grown. So it's probably not a literal thing.
Yeah, that's a rabbit trail that I'm not sure yet that we have the answers to. But the thing that's interesting is, I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth passed away. There's no longer any sea. Why mm-hmm. is sea singled out? That mm-hmm. it's clearly something's going on. The sea is singled out. It doesn't say there are no more mountains, no more valleys, no mm-hmm. more rivers. And what we know is this: the sea was, as you noted already, widely used throughout the biblical text as the antithesis to the divine or to the creation. In other words, the sea in the Genesis 1 and 2, even all the way through chapter of the book of Genesis, the sea is anti-creation. The sea is the place where the sea monsters are, and we discussed that with Dr. Broadhurst. The idea that Satan is a dragon comes from this cosmic imagery of the sea as the place of sea monsters, and maybe someday we'll do some stuff on Genesis chapter 1 because it's very interesting. There are sea monsters that are specifically mm-hmm. singled out in Genesis chapter 1, and he made the sea monsters, the Tanin. Why are they singled, the monsters of the sea? Oh, because they're created by God. God can mm-hmm. tame them, as the book of Job says. But the sea then is associated with this idea of decreation. And what in the Genesis 1 account is that God has to separate the waters in order to create the dry ground. The waters are not allowing for the formation of land animals. So we have to separate that. And of course, before that, he separated the waters from waters. He made the sky so that the birds can be in the sky. The sea is inhibiting the creation, or it's anti-creation in that sense there. Then you see in Genesis chapter 7, 8, and even into 9, where God floods the world. And what he's doing is he's bringing the waters back over the land, saying, okay, I separated the waters to create the land and make land with animals and man. And now, because of the corruption, I'm going to put man in a boat and I'm going to bring the waters back over the land. So you see the idea of God destroying it. Also, you see in the book of Revelation, the great prostitute sits on many waters in chapter 17, verse 1. And then, of course, chapter 17, verse 15 says, the waters upon which the woman sits are many nations, peoples, multitudes, and tongues. Oh, so the sea has this imagery of the nations that are opposing God's people. In the book of Revelation, the word sea occurs 26 times. And it's almost always connected with that which is opposed to God. So in chapter 12, the dragon stood on the sand of the seashore. The beast comes up out of the sea. In 20 verse 13 that we just looked at in the last section, the sea is the place of the dead that's emptied so its occupants can be brought before the great white throne for the judgment. So the sea, Barbara Rossing says it this way. She says, Revelation portrays the sea politically and economically, as well as mythologically, as a location of evil and a place where commercial ships sail. The eschatological end of the sea in 21:1 must be read as more economic than mythological, hailing the end of Rome's cargo, ships, and trade. And I think that's actually a really good way of saying it. One more quote. So Resigui says, the sea represents threat. It's the place of chaos where terrifying monsters of the deep lurk, such as Leviathan and Rahab. The sea is a metonym. The word metonym means the White House would be a metonym for the president or whatever. The White House said, it's like the White House is a building. It doesn't speak. So it's just something that's in place of something else representing it. So the sea is a metonym for everything that is recalcitrant to the will of God. In light of this, it stands to reason that in order for there to be a new heaven and a new earth, there must be no longer any sea. So yeah, so does that mean that there's oceans and waters and rivers? There's a river. We know that in the New Jerusalem. That's Revelation 22:1. I don't think we have an answer to that because the New Jerusalem doesn't describe any oceans, but you can't use this verse to say that there is no longer any waters of seas because, as you mentioned, that's not what it's getting at.
We hope you're enjoying the podcast, and we want to remind you that everything we do at Determined Truth, the podcast, Rob's blog, and our YouTube channel is available on the Determined Truth app. Directions on how to download the app is available in the show notes and on the DeterminedTruth.com website. Just click on the app tab.
Verse 2 then continues talking about the New Jerusalem, which obviously if there's a New Jerusalem, that means there was an Old Jerusalem. What are we to make of this, and what's the relationship between the New and the Old Jerusalems?
So I'm actually writing a book on this right now. I'm writing a book on Israel, the land, and the people, and specifically in relationship to the war in Gaza and what's going on, because the common justification, as we did in the live stream with Daryl Bach, the reality is this argument ultimately gets back. If you push this argument back and this argument back and this argument back and this argument back, you eventually get to the point where, but God gave them the land. That becomes the question. And one of the things I'm pointing out in the book is you have all these verses, and let's not take the time to necessarily read them all, but I have some of them on the notes in front of us. But Isaiah 62, 1 through 5, Isaiah 65, 17 through 20, that's new heavens and a new earth language there. Isaiah 52, 1, Galatians 4, 26, Philippians 3, 20, Hebrews 11, 10, which actually is a really interesting verse there. It says, Abraham was looking for a city which has foundations, whose architect and builder is God. Abraham was looking for a different city, this eschatological city. And then you have Hebrews 12, 12, 12, 22, and 13, 14. And what you have in the biblical text is these promises that Jerusalem will be forever. It'll be the eternal city of God. And one of the things I'm arguing in this book is that can't be fulfilled by the present day Jerusalem because there's a new heaven and a new earth. Jerusalem doesn't last forever. It can only be fulfilled in an eschatological sense in the New Jerusalem of Revelation 21 and 22. So if the fulfillment of the promise that Jerusalem is going to be the everlasting city of God can only be in the eschatological city of God, but the eschatological city of God, and eschatological just means like the end times. So this end times city of the New Jerusalem, the holy city, the bride that comes down out of heaven from God, that has to be what these promises are looking forward to because it's the eternal one. But then you look at that the city and that description, which we'll get into in the next couple of weeks, and you realize, first off, it extends way beyond the borders of modern-day Jerusalem. So even if there is a correspondence to the physical world today and the resurrected physical world of the New Jerusalem, it's not the old city of Jerusalem as we know it because its dimensions are 12,000 stadia, which is, you know, 1,400, 1,500 miles. It's this expansive city that, and I'll argue this on the podcast, and I'll argue this, of course, in the book as well, that actually fills the whole earth. It's Eden restored, and Eden was to fill the earth. It doesn't say that in Genesis, but that seems to be implied. Mm-hmm. And later biblical writers absolutely pick up on this theme. The whole earth is full of his glory. And I think that's the relationship then. It's this eschatological fulfillment of Jerusalem and the promise that Jerusalem will be the everlasting city that happens in the resurrection of the new creation. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. With the new Jerusalem then, obviously the old Jerusalem is going to be tied to the temple. And even you read the gospel accounts and Jesus goes to Jerusalem. Why? So he could go to the temple. This is the significance of that city as being the capital. With the new Jerusalem, what connection do we see with a temple?
Okay, and we're going to flush this out a lot in the next couple mm-hmm. episodes, but this is actually the other key. One of the things that I argue in the book that I'm writing right now, which I argue this a little bit a lot in These Brothers of Mine, as well as in Understanding the New Testament and the End Times. In both those books, I make this argument, but I'll explain it more thoroughly in the book that I'm writing right now. And that is the reason why Jerusalem is important, or the land of Israel is important, is because that's where the temple was going to dwell. In other words, we think of it as, oh, God made this land promise to the Jewish people. Therefore, God has to fulfill the land promises to the Jewish people. And what I point out is, why did God make the land promises? What's the point of the land promise? Was it just because, okay, Abraham, the Jewish people, you're my special ones. That's great. Everybody else is second-class citizens. And I'm going to give you this land that you can live in there forever and you'll be good. Or is it, Abraham, I'm choosing you to be the special people among whom I'm going to dwell. What made Abraham and the Jewish people special was because God would dwell among them, and then they would be blessed as a result of God's presence, and everyone else would go, oh, let's join them. The nations would flock to Jerusalem. Okay, that doesn't happen. So Jesus comes along and says, I'll put my spirit within you, and then you go out to the nations. The land then becomes the place where God would dwell. So the people, the Jewish people, as you want to say it that way, are the people among whom God would dwell. The land becomes the place amongst which God would dwell. So the New Jerusalem is a temple, and we'll flesh this out in more detail in the next couple episodes, because it is where God dwells. I will dwell among them, and I will be their God, and they will be my people. That you just read in 21:3 and then 21 verse 7. So what I'll argue in the next few episodes is that the holy city actually comprises the entirety of creation. And maybe the way of explaining it would be this. If you look at 21:1 and 21:2, it almost seems like there's two things that are mentioned. I saw a new heavens and a new earth, 21:1, and then I saw the holy city, 21 verse 2. But those are not two different things. It's the same thing. When John saw the new heavens and the new earth, what he saw was the holy city.
And then the end of verse 2 says the holy city was like a bride adorned for her husband.
Yeah, that becomes the next point, and that is the holy city, the new Jerusalem, and the bride are actually going to be the same thing. And we're going to see this later on in this episode, as well as in the next episode, as we discuss more detail, 21:9 through 22:9. The bride is the city, and what we recognize is actually in Ezekiel 16, verses 8 through 14, Israel's depicted as a bride, finely adorned. And in Hosea chapter 4, verse 5, Israel's a mother, the personification of Israel, or the personification of Jerusalem, being a personification just means to have the attributes or qualities of a person. That's exactly what's happening here. He doesn't see a new heavens and a new earth, and also the holy city is the new heavens and the new earth, but he actually isn't describing a city. He's describing the bride, the people of God, as if it were a city.
Yeah. Okay. Verses 3 and 4. John hears this loud voice from the throne. We know that you've trained us to say that hearing and seeing are things that pop up through the story. So is this a matter of hearing? Should we be pinged to that?
Yeah. So in verse 2, it says, I saw the holy city. And in verse 3, I heard a loud voice from the throne. And what he hears is the tabernacle of God is among men. He will dwell among them, and they will be his people, and God himself will be among them. So I think you do have this idea of hearing and seeing. And what we've discussed before, if you're new to the episodes, is that hearing and seeing is a rhetorical thing that John uses. The most famous example is in chapter 5. he heard that the lion from the tribe of Judah had overcome. But then he looked in verse 6, and I saw a lamb that was slain. And we realized the lion and the lamb are the same thing, two images for Jesus. And so John does this consistently where he'll say, I saw this and I heard this, or I heard this and I saw this. So he hears that the tabernacle of God's among men, but what he saw was the holy city. And the answer is exactly. The hearing and seeing is the same thing. What he sees, of course, is that the New Jerusalem is the dwelling of God among people. This is really significant. What's happening is this. There's a covenant promise of God. And this is what I am arguing in the book, and it's in my book, Understanding the New Testament and the End Times, and again in These Brothers of Mine, and that is that God calls Abraham and his people to be his covenant people. And in Leviticus 26, 11 and 12, it says, moreover, I will make my dwelling among you. My soul will not reject you, and I will walk among you and be your God, and you shall be my people. Now, the phrase, I will walk among you, or the word walk, links to Genesis 3, verse 8. God walked in the garden in the cool of the day. And it's very likely that we have this Eden imagery. And what's happening is this. Leviticus 26 is the blessings and the curses passage. The blessings are, if you obey my covenant, these will be your blessings. You'll have long life, and I'll protect you from enemy invasions, and your cattle will do well. And then the blessings actually end with, and I will make my dwelling among you. I will not reject you. I'll walk among you, and I'll be your God, and you'll be my people. So it's part of this covenant promise that God has made. We call this the Emmanuel principle, that God will dwell among his people. Now, when we go to the book of Ezekiel, what we find out is Ezekiel reiterates this again, because Ezekiel, the people are living in exile. You've been kicked out of the land, and they're thinking, oh, no. Oh, no, what are we going to do? The king likes Daniel more than me and you. Oh, no. It's just where mind goes sometimes. Yeah. Anyways, the people of Judah have been exiled into Babylon. They have got to be thinking traumatically. Obviously, our God's not the supreme God, because we were overtaken by a foreign nation. This is a bad stay. And Ezekiel says, no, God has not forsaken you, and he will restore you. And he says in Ezekiel 37, verses 26 and 27, the passage really starts in verse 24, but in verse 26 and 27, it says, I will place them and multiply them, and I'll set my sanctuary in their midst forever. My dwelling place also will be with them, and I'll be their God, and they'll be my people. And so it's this reiteration of this covenant promise that God's going to restore them to the land, and when he does, he'll dwell among them. Now, what's really significant is we jump to the book of Revelation, and we see, of course, Chapter 21, verse 3, it reiterates this promise. And 21, verse 7, I'll be God to him, and he himself, or they themselves, will be my son, my people. This is the reiteration of the promise. But what's critical for us, Vinny, is Paul quotes in 2 Corinthians 6, verse 16.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Paul quotes Leviticus and Ezekiel to say, mm-hmm. You in Corinth, you are the temple of the living God. As it says, I will dwell among them, and I will be their God, and they will be my people. That means it's a present reality now, because the Holy Spirit dwells in us. So it has to have this radical transformation on who we are now and in the present.
That's good.
Hey, everyone. We want to thank you for joining us on today's podcast. And we want to remind you that everything we provide at Determined Truth is free of charge. And this even includes all of the teaching that Rob does on a weekly basis to pastors in India and around the world. We don't have any supporters that get special behind-the-scenes access. But we can only do this with the generous support that comes from those of you who can afford to give. So if you would prayerfully consider supporting us with anything from $5 a month or more, we will continue to work hard to challenge the church to be the church. To give, go to DeterminedTruth.com and click on the Give tab, or follow the link in the show notes.
So in verse 5, we also have the voice. So it's the one seated on the throne who is going to wipe away every tear from their eyes. There's no longer going to be any death. Mm-hmm. No longer mourning, nor crying, nor pain. And this is ultimately, finally, this is what we're hoping for.
Yeah, exactly. And what we see is the Father speaks twice in the book of Revelation. There are voices that come from the throne in other places in the book of Revelation, but it never is the one that's on the throne speaking. In fact, other instances that voice comes from the throne are not God. It refers to God as a third person there. So it can't actually be the one that's sitting on the throne. But twice in the book of Revelation, the Father speaks from the throne, and it's chapter 1, verse 8, and chapter 21, verse 5, and it seems to serve as this frame of
bookends,
the beginning. The book ends at the beginning and the end. So,
Okay. Verse 5, the Father, he speaks again, and he says, because these words are faithful and they are true.
And we're going to see the commander write several times during the closing of the book. And so guess how many times in the book of Revelation John's commanded to write?
I'm going to go with 12 because that's what the notes say.
You're cheating. You cheated. I shouldn't have read that.
It's only cheating if you get caught. That's what John Madden used to say. If you're not cheating, you're not trying hard.
John is commanded to write 12 times. And again, that tells us the central focus is he's writing to the people of God. He's writing to the church. We have to keep that in mind as we finish up the book.
Okay. Verse 6. And he said to me, "It is done."
Yeah, there you go.
Gosh, can't wait to hear those words.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it is done. How long, O Lord? Right? That's been the whole cry of the whole book. How long, O Lord? And it is done. This, of course, this is the indication that the final judgment has happened and been fulfilled, and now heaven and earth have become one again. It is done.
In verse 6, the Father again reiterates what we saw in chapter 1.
Yeah.
I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. And this is just speaking of the eternality of God, right?
Yeah, the idea that God is the Alpha and the Omega doesn't mean he's the beginning and the end, like he has a beginning point and mm-hmm. that there's an end point. We know that there's no end point. The New Jerusalem goes on forever and ever. So in Greek, the implication is that I'm before the Alpha and I'm after the Omega, and Alpha and Omega are the first and last letters of the Greek alphabet. Mm-hmm. So what's interesting is there are three titles, the first and the last, the beginning and the end, the Alpha and the Omega. And we see all three titles in chapter 22, verse 13. All three are there applied to Jesus. But I'm the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end, expresses God's timelessness. I've brought about the cosmic restoration of creation. Eden and the world have become one again, and heaven and earth have become one. Wow.
Mm. Awesome. Okay. In verse 6, we also hear from the Father that I myself will give freely from the spring of the water of life. Or in the ESV, it says, I will give from the spring of the water of life without payment.
Without cost. Yeah. Might be a better way of translating that. Because payment means it costs something, but you didn't have to pay it. The implication of that is that it's water and it's free. And imagine the poor and the marginalized and the oppressed who struggle every day to get water. I don't know if I've shared this with you before or not, Vinny, but World Vision often does this fundraiser, I guess you might call it. Mm-hmm. I don't actually ever do it for raising any funds, but it's annually, and it's in the month of April, which is like, can you do it a little bit earlier in the year? Because it's already 120 degrees here in Arizona now. Mm. But what they do is it's a 6-kilometer walk, and they give you like this orange World Vision shirt, because that's the average distance that people in third world countries travel each day to get water, 3 kilometers up and 3 kilometers back. And what, 3 kilometers is 1.8 miles, a little bit more than 1.8 miles. So all total, it's 3.75 miles to get water and come back. And so when I do it, I go out from the house and come back like 1.8 miles. And then the second 1.8 miles I do, I'm carrying water because they're not just walking 3.7 miles. They're walking the second half of that carrying gallons of water. And I'm telling you, that's hard. Now, obviously, I don't put it on my head. That might make it a little bit easier. But carrying water, it gets heavy. You put a couple of gallons of jugs of water in your arms and you're going 1.8 miles or whatever. It's not easy to do. So imagine what this sounds like to somebody there or people in Gaza. 97% of the water is not drinkable. Mm-hmm. And the average person in Gaza gets 2 to 3 liters of water a day. Now, I wrote a blog on this.
For all their needs.
Yeah, it's not enough for any of their needs. When you flush a toilet,
it's
under 4 gallons of water, 4 liters of water. Yeah.
Bathing, brushing your teeth, anything that you use water on.
A shower running for 1 minute is about 10 liters of water. Just to let your shower warm up, which we don't have to do here in Arizona in the summertime. It's already warm. But brushing your teeth, letting the water run. The World Health Organization says that a person needs about 100 liters of water a day for all their needs, cleaning, hygiene, drinking, food preparation, things of that nature. And the average person in Gaza right now, because they cut water off, is getting 2 to 3 liters of water a day. It's you can't survive on that. And so imagine for them to go, what? There's a place where there's water in abundance and it's free? Yeah, this is awesome.
Who are these people that need water in Revelation?
The poor, the marginalized, the oppressed. The people in Rome don't need it. They have plenty of it provided for them. I'm not sure exactly what you were asking. Is that where you're going with the question?
I'm just curious if I'm hearing this in the story itself, because we were talking a little bit about the application, mm-hmm. but in the story itself, who is the people that are going to benefit from receiving this water without payment?
Yeah, it's the ones that don't have access to it as easily and regularly as everybody else does. And let me give kind of another anecdote here. I teach in India 4 times a week to different groups of pastors, about 100 pastors altogether. And we always do a prayer time at the end. And it's very common, the prayer time at the end. This person's sick. This pastor's sick. His wife is sick. His mother's sick. His daughter's sick. And it's because they don't have access to as good a water as we have. Now, I can't say that to them. The reason why you're sick is because you don't have good water, but it's the food. When you go to some of these countries, you don't eat apple because if it's been washed in the water, you're just going to get sick from it. Because we as Americans, we don't have the stuff in our stomachs to help and protect them. But water, I went to Guatemala with my daughter on a missions trip there. More people die of the lack of access to clean water than die from a lack of access to food every day in the world. Wow. Water is a bigger problem. And in Guatemala, the kids are regularly sick. They regularly miss school because of their sickness. That stifles their physical growth, and it also hinders their educational abilities. So water is just this critical thing to have an access to clean water. So we went there to Guatemala and installed like a purification system so that the water that they do have, they can get it filtered. Mm-hmm. And the church has the water. So people have to come to the church to get the water, and they can, the church can sell it at a reasonable cost to the people in the village. It's a great ministry and it's tremendous, but we don't think about this. We let the shower run and then we go, oh, it's still getting warm. I'll brush my teeth right now. And then we let the water run, brushing our teeth. And then, oh, I forgot my clothes. And the shower's been hot for 5 minutes. That's 10 liters a minute. It's, yeah, this is good news.
Wow.
Yeah.
Verses 7 and 8 wrap up this section. And it really distinguishes between God's people and God's enemies, or the enemies of Jesus. Or as we've said through the book, the people who have the mark of the Lamb are sealed by God, or have the mark of the beast and worship the world system. Those are the two kind of categories of people we have right here.
Yeah. And the difference between the two groups of people is, to whom do you give allegiance? Do you give allegiance to God, or do you give allegiance to self, or to the beast, or to the prostitute, whatever it may be? And the people of God are, the one who overcomes will inherit these things. Ah, there's that one who overcomes again from the seven messages. The one who overcomes will inherit these things. And notice that to give allegiance to God requires overcoming. And then those who don't overcome, those who give allegiance to self or the beast or whatever, there's eight items listed in the list. And it's always important to remember that when you have a list, count the number. And interestingly, it's eight because it's not seven, because this is evil, negative characteristics. And what's intriguing about this list, and there are three lists here at the end of the book, one here in 21:8, one in 21:27, and one in 22:15, that the list, each of the lists has liars at the end of it, lying and deception. And you have to remember, the Satan is the deceiver, and he came to deceive us. And that's huge as we get into the modern political things that we've been getting into there also. So yeah, it's really significant. Yeah. All right. So let me ask you, Vinny, really quickly here as we finish up, and we'll get into this some more as we proceed. When you think of the new creation or what have you pastorally, how what are some things that kind of come to your mind in a pastoral context that you might say to, let's say, our listeners here today? And remember, they're not viewers, because you don't see anyone.
All of them. I see them all in my heart, Rob.
I want to see them.
Yeah. Well, first off, I think there's what we alluded to earlier, which is the idea of creation and creation care. How ought we be stewards? God is one day going to renew all things. And so I think we should even ask ourselves, what part do we play in that? Yeah, even physically with ourselves. And we do things to better ourselves physically. We talk about how our bodies are a temple, so eat better, exercise, or those sorts of things. Not that the world is a temple, it is, but it's, God doesn't live in buildings made by human hands. But the idea is, are we just taking creation seriously in terms of how we steward these things, whether it's ourselves, whether it's the resources we can help provide for other people so they could steward those things as well? Just what are we doing with that? So I think there's just a call that we constantly need to be checking ourselves in that. We've had many of those conversations in terms of the technology we use, and what resources go into making those technologies. And so I think there's just a lot that we don't just figure it out and then move on. That's something that we need to evaluate, because the world changes on a daily basis. and our amenities change on a daily basis. We just not constantly need to be pursuing that and thinking about that. So I think that's the first thing that I think.
There's a lot of places that we can go here. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I think about is, I mentioned it earlier, Titus chapter 2, I think it's verse 13, says, while we wait for the blessed hope, the glorious appearing of our great God and Savior, Jesus Christ. The plea in the book of Revelation has been, how long, O Lord, how long? And we're called as followers of Jesus Christ to take up our cross and follow him. And you and I talked about this before we got on the live stream itself, that it's just not easy right now. It's just, and it's, I don't think it's supposed to be easy. And I think we're experiencing, oh, I guess we have to carry our crosses too, Lord. I'm not sure I like this part. I like telling everybody else to carry their crosses. But let me just briefly mention this. My commentary in the book of Revelation, I hope it'll be out by the fall of 2024, whenever you're listening to this. And I was going through some edits. I had to go through some edits at the final process there. And I noticed again that I dedicated the book to our son, Jason. I don't know how much you remember about this, Vinny, but you know, we had a son, Jason. We named him Jason. He died in the womb, 20 weeks old. We gave birth to him in 2004. My wife and I still honor and respect his birthday every year. And here's the dedication page. It says, this book is dedicated to our son, Jason Robert Dalrymple, died 2004. So I thought I could do this. To all those whose loved ones have gone before them. The book of Revelation is a book of hope. A hope that we will dwell in the presence of the Eternal One, where we will see his face. A hope that someday there will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain. A hope that someday there will be no more hunger or thirst. A hope that we will not need to fear the onslaught of torrential rains and floods or the fierceness of the scorching sun and drought. A hope that we will live without fear. A hope that we will live in peace. A hope that we will be reunited with loved ones for eternity. For my wife and me, we long for the day when we will get to meet our son and be with him forever and to share the joy with all of you as you embrace those whom you have lost as well, especially the ones that you've never met. And so it just sustains us a little bit, right, during those times. And again, be careful if you come across someone who's lost a loved one. Don't say it's going to be, don't say that to them. Just give them a hug and sit with them. But for those of you who are suffering that loss, just be reminded of the blessed hope and what it means for us.
Well, and it's supposed to hurt because it's not supposed to be that way.
That's why Jesus wept, I think, at the tomb of Lazarus. I think so.
And that was the other thing I was going to say is I think that idea for that there is no more tears, there's no more pain. Sometimes we can make it a joke to be like, okay, I won't get out of bed and my back won't be hurting. And there's the just because the heart of entropy where the world is breaking down. But it is truly looking at it where how much water did I use? I used more water this morning on my family than those kids in Guatemala or Gaza are going to use all week probably. And it's thinking it's not supposed to be that way. This isn't the way it's supposed to be. And we ought to mourn for that in the same way I would be mourning if my kid didn't have what he needed. But I know he does. Just I walked my son to school this morning and there was water runoff from the sprinklers. And it's like the fact that water runoff that was sitting in the street, how much of that, like how many people would just like literally salivate over having that ability to have that water and it's just sitting in the ground and I just walk through it.
Yeah, and they would sit in your gutters and drink it because they, especially the people in Gaza and Sudan.
Yep.
And let me add to this also, the New Jerusalem is not just this, we've discussed this already, but I want to reiterate the point, not just this future thing that we long for, but it's this present thing that we're supposed to be working towards now. So we're supposed to be working towards not just the day, hey, guess what, you guys in Gaza, don't worry about it, someday it'll be okay. No, we need to get them water now. Yep. We need to work towards water now. We need to work towards clean water around the world now. And not just remind them of the blessed hope that's coming.
And I think that's part of praying the Lord's Prayer and saying, your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. But that's partly saying God's kingdom is coming. Have some water because guess what? In the New Jerusalem, you will have no need for this. I won't have to deliver this for you. You'll just have it.
Yeah, said. That's what Jesus was doing when he did his miracles. He's like, you are now going to see because in my kingdom, there's no blindness. You now are going to walk because in my kingdom, there's no lameness. You now are going to drink because in my kingdom, there'll be free water. Exactly.
So next, we'll actually get into the New Jerusalem because we just got the preview to it. And then so verse 9 of 21 is where we'll start up next week.
Absolutely. And then we've got some wonderful scholars coming on to discuss their views of Revelation and the beast and all that good stuff coming up as well. So looking forward to it, Vinny. Thank you.
Yeah. All right, everyone. Catch you guys next week.
I want to thank you for joining us on today's podcast, and we would love for you to share the work of Determined Truth with others. please follow this podcast and give a review on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Your review will go a long way towards helping others find this podcast. Then, share it with others so that we can get the word of the gospel of the kingdom to more people.